From the moment he became president, Johnson had authority over every aspect of the cover-up of Kennedy's murder. He was unassailable.
Johnson has the power to contain the investigation, both nationally and locally, on the ground in Texas. More so than if it had happened, let's say, in Oregon or Wisconsin, Texas. He's got the power to give the CIA what it wants as president, as opposed to Kennedy, who they feared. He's got the power to take the National Security Action Memorandum that Kennedy had signed in November 1963, tear it up, reverse it, and create a war where 3 million soldiers wound up going to Vietnam instead of 16,000 being brought home by JFK. He can make J. Edgar Hoover director of the FBI for life. He's the man in the middle. The only person that can answer all of the questions of who's at risk, who's going to gain the most, who wins in this deal, there's only one answer to that question, and that's Lyndon Johnson. And his ticket out was Elm Street.
Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. In this week's episode, we're going to talk about an individual who don't get mentioned that much in the assassination story, and I don't know why. Malcolm Mack Wallace was an ex-Marines marksman and a convicted murderer, and he had direct ties to Lyndon Johnson. Six eyewitnesses see a man on the sixth floor of the school book depository minutes before the assassination that fits the description of Mack Wallace. And while it's no surprise that Lee Harvey Oswald's prints were found on the sixth floor because he worked up there, his job was moving boxes around and filling orders, so his fingerprints should be found on the sixth floor of the depository. But guess whose fingerprints were also found on the sixth floor of the depository, on a box at the sniper's nest? Malcolm Mack Wallace. And just for the record, he didn't work there.
Something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
This just in from Dallas, Homicide Chief Captain Will Fritz said today, the assassination case against Lee Harvey Oswald is cinched. He said flatly, this is the man that killed President Kennedy, 24-year-old Lee Harvey Oswald.
So who is Malcolm Mack Wallace? To make a long story short, Wallace was an ex-U.S. Marine who in October 1950 was introduced to Lyndon Baines Johnson by Johnson's attorney Edward Clark. Wallace would soon begin working with the United States Department of Agriculture in Texas. Wallace began having an affair with LBJ's sister, Jophia Johnson. Jophia was also having a relationship with John Kinzer, the owner of a golf course in Austin. Kinzer asked Jophia to approach her brother for financial help. When Johnson refused to help, it is believed that Kinzer resorted to blackmail. According to Barr McClellan, the author of Blood, Money, and Power, How LBJ Killed JFK, Kinzer asked Jophia if she could arrange for her brother to loan him some money. Johnson interpreted this as a blackmail threat. Jophia had told Kinzer about some of her brother's corrupt activities. On October 22, 1951, Mack Wallace went to Kinzer's golf course. After finding Kinzer in the golf shop, he shot him several times before escaping in his station wagon. A customer at the golf course had heard the shooting and managed to make a note of Wallace's license plate. The local police force was able to use this information to arrest Mack Wallace. Wallace was charged with murder, but was released on bail after Edward Clark arranged for two of Johnson's financial supporters, M.E. Ruby and Bill Carroll, to post bonds on behalf of Wallace. Another one of Johnson's attorneys, John Cofer, also agreed to represent Wallace. On February 1, 1952, Wallace resigned from his government job in order to distance himself from Lyndon Johnson. His trial began 17 days later. Wallace did not testify. Cofer admitted his client's guilt but claimed it was an act of revenge, as Kinzer had been sleeping with Wallace's girlfriend. The jury found Wallace guilty of murder with malice. 11 of the jurors were for the death penalty. The 12th argued for life imprisonment. Judge Charles Betts overruled the jury and announced a sentence of 5 years imprisonment. He suspended the sentence and Wallace was immediately freed. Unbelievable. According to Bill Alder of the Texas Observer, several of the jurors telephoned John Kinzer's parents to apologize for agreeing to a suspended sentence, but said they did so only because threats had been made against their families. Over the next 10 years, Mack Wallace is believed to be involved in several murders in order to protect the political career of Lyndon Johnson. One of the most compelling pieces of evidence linking Johnson with the assassination of JFK is through his henchman Mack Wallace, the convicted killer of John Kinzer. In the hours following the assassination on the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository building by the southeast corner sniper's nest window, the Dallas police discovered an unidentified fingerprint.
The fingerprint is the ultimate part of the Mack Wallace story. The FBI fingerprinted every Texas School Book Depository employee, including the women employees that worked downstairs, never handled the boxes. They fingerprinted every Dallas officer that was in the sniper's nest so that they could remove those fingerprints from consideration. At the end of the day, you have one fingerprint remaining. It sits in the National Archives for 35 years, until 1998. An investigator takes it to a highly qualified, certified latent print examiner, a CLPE, along with a redacted fingerprint card from Mack Wallace from the 1951 murder of John Douglas Kinzer. And he said, here's a print card. Do you see anything?
In the 90s, Nathan Darby was one of the most experienced fingerprint experts in the United States, with 35 years service in the U.S. military and the City of Austin Police Department.
I didn't know where it came from, and a week or 10 days later, I called the party and said it brought it over and said, well, it's a match. The finger that made the ink print also made the latent, and we call that a match or identified, and there was no question about it. They matched.
3 years later, Nathan Darby readdressed the same evidence and reconfirmed his original findings.
When he was done, he had a 34-point match. And when you mention that in criminal circles to an investigator, how confident would you feel with a 34-point match? Oh, that's a slam dunk. It can't miss. It doesn't get any better than that. You give me a 34-point match on any case in the United States, I'll take it to court and win.
The inked and the latent print are made by the same finger. And the other evidence that I've been presented with was Malcolm Wallace's left little finger, without a reasonable doubt.
Now, the fingerprint in question came from a cardboard box in the sniper's nest in Texas School Book Depository. Fingerprints do not last long on cardboard. So it's fair to say that either Malcolm Wallace was wandering around there for no purpose, he was in that sniper's nest on November 22nd. That evidence, that fingerprint evidence, along with Malcolm Wallace's sordid resume, was sent to every imaginable agency or individual that could have an interest in what happened to John Kennedy. The only people that took notice of it were the Dallas police, because it's still an open homicide on their blotter. And they took serious notice of it. And then they were told, forward it up the line, because Dallas no longer has any evidence. It's all in federal hands, even though it's an unsolved homicide. They forwarded it up the line. And it took 18 months for the FBI to say verbally, no, it's not a match. And the single most important fingerprint found in the last 35 years was buried.
I don't know why they couldn't say that, or say that the thing didn't match. It did match. There's no question about it. My experience, I've just had too much experience. I know what I'm talking about. I'm positive. There's no question about it. My dying declaration, if I was to drop dead right now, they match.
It's still the big lie. It's unknown. It's unidentified. No, it's identified. It's Malcolm Wallace, and he's linked to Estes, Carter, and Lyndon B. Johnson directly.
Malcolm Wallace went to work for Harry Lewis and Ellen G. Oll. In 1970, he returned to Dallas and began pressing Edward Clark for more money for his part in the assassination of John Kennedy. According to Barr McClellan, it was then decided to kill Wallace. McClellan says, quote, he had to be eliminated. After driving to see his daughter in Troop, Texas, he went by L&G's offices in Longview, Texas. There, his exhaust pipe was rigged for part of its flow to flow into the car, end quote. Later that day, on January 7, 1971, Malcolm Wallace was killed while driving in Pittsburgh, Texas. He appeared to have fallen asleep and after leaving the road crashed his car. Wallace died of massive head injuries. 8 months later, another key member of LBJ's inner circle, presidential aide Cliff Carter, died unexpectedly. But shortly before his death, Carter met with Billy Sol Estes.
They discuss all these murders that Cliff Carter is knowledgeable about. Now, Billy knows about some of them, but Cliff knows about more, and he fills him in on all the details. Malcolm Wallace being a central figure in most of these murders. And there were over 17 murders that Carter tells Estes about. And he actually tells Estes that he fears for his own life. And within 2 days' time, he's dead.
Lyndon Johnson's attorney, Edward Clark, was one person who prospered. But when LBJ was brought low by the Vietnam War and decided not to run for a second term, Clark felt shortchanged for his role in the assassination of Kennedy, according to his legal partner, Barr McClellan.
He expected $8 million spread over 8 years, over the two terms Johnson was to serve. When those terms were cut short by Johnson's sudden and unexpected resignation, Clark was $4 million short. He was not a man to be denied. When he had done a service, he was going to be paid. Planning ahead, he went to Big Oil and Big D, went to Clint Murchison to say, look, I've done y'all a great service. I deserve more. I'm going to get it. Murchison agreed with him and suggested he file for a well in the middle of the Great East Texas oil field. He called me in as his personal attorney to make the first bid for getting that money. And he was not successful in getting $4 million, but he got his $2 million. So when all was said and done, Clark realized $6 million. For the assassination of John Kennedy.
Barr McClellan claimed that the killing of Kennedy was paid for by oil millionaires such as Clint Murchison and Howard Hunt. McClellan claims that Clark got $2 million for his work in the assassination. The death of Kennedy allowed the oil depletion allowance to be kept at 27.5%. It remained unchanged during the Johnson presidency. According to McClellan, this resulted in a saving of over $100 million to the American oil industry. Soon after Johnson left office, it dropped to 15%. Barr McClellan believes documented proof of these dark deeds by Johnson lies in the Johnson-Clark legal records. For many years, they were kept in high security area above the Clark offices in Austin, Texas, known as the penthouse.
Any of us attorneys could get into the general area, but the secret area, the Johnson area, was locked off. Accessible to no one. I have a strong belief that there are substantial records somewhere that show this conspiracy and its both evolution, its execution, and its cover-up. I don't know where they'd be. We need to see them.
Lyndon Johnson was ultimately consumed by the Hall office that he had so coveted. A broken man, he retreated to his ranch in Stonewall, Texas, where his lawyers were to secretly summon a psychiatrist to deal with his deepening depression.
An immediate concern at the law firm was that he would say too much. $1 million was available to the psychiatrist to keep anything from coming out. The one reason for all these protections was the greatest demon that was dogging Johnson at the time, and that was the assassination of John Kennedy and the role he played in it. We had to keep it covered up, and for sure we had to keep the psychiatrist muzzled, and we did. But if any one set of records needs to be produced, the psychiatric records should be disclosed to the American public, because they will, I am confident, disclose his role in the assassination.
Only 4 years after leaving office, Lyndon Johnson died. On January 12, 1973, he recorded an hour-long television interview with newsman Walter Cronkite at his ranch. In the interview, he discussed his legacy, particularly about the civil rights movement. Johnson was smoking heavily, and he told Cronkite that it was better for his heart to, quote, to smoke than to be nervous, end quote. He was living with the demons of his past. 10 days later, at approximately 3:39 p.m. Central Standard Time, on January 22, 1973, Johnson suffered a major heart attack in his bedroom. During his attack, he managed to telephone the Secret Service agents on the ranch, who found him still holding the telephone receiver unconscious and appearing to be dead. Despite the fact that Johnson has been dead for over 50 years now, there are still some alive who are afraid to come forward to tell what they know about Johnson's role in the Kennedy assassination.
People are afraid of him dead. He's been dead since 1973, and his shadow still casts fear in this country, especially in Texas.
Just as John Kennedy's car took an incredible turn when it went onto Elm Street, 300 feet later, our form of government, our way of life, our way of respecting our government, our way of being respected by our government, took that same kind of bizarre wide turn. And we haven't gotten back on the straight and narrow yet.